Catholic Answers Live. That music means it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. If you've got a weird question, you can get it to Jimmy Akin. One of the various ways people contact Jimmy Akin, or you can just send it to us here at radio@catholic.com. If I see him, I just forward him to Jimmy. And then sometimes, actually, most of the time, I see him show up on this show. So weird questions, welcome. And lots of people have availed themselves of that invitation because we got a whole bunch of weird questions. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which is regularly among the top documentary podcasts in the whole country, maybe the whole earth. I don't know how that works, but it's big, though.
Yeah, we got over 100,000 listeners a week.
Oh, do you really? Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. Well, back to the weird questions. Now I'm a little, I don't know, there might be so many listeners. I'm a little nervous now, but all right. Timothy asks this. If all creatures were the same size, which would be the most dangerous and why is it amoebas?
Well, I think it's going to depend on the size that you make them. Because animals are built to operate at certain scales. You know, this is often pointed out, for example, like, you know how in the 1950s they had all those movies like The Beginning of the End and Tarantula, where you had a creature that's normally very small, or them, like a spider or an ant or a grasshopper, blown up to giant size, and they become a threat to humanity. And whenever you read scientific assessments of those movies, it's always pointed out this would not work in reality because these creatures are designed to work on the small scale. But if you blew them up, their exoskeletons would be too weak to support them. They would be crushed by their own weight. They also wouldn't be able to breathe because of how their respiration works. They're not designed, their breathing apparatuses are not designed to work on a large scale. They're designed to work on a small scale. And so it depends who's going to be most dangerous is going to depend on what size you're shrinking the animals to. Are you shrinking elephants down to the size of microbes? Or are you expanding microbes up to the size of elephants? You know, where's mm-hmm. where, what are you using as your frame of reference for how big you're going to make them? And that's going to affect the answer, because if you expanded amoebas up to the size of elephants, they wouldn't be able to move. They would probably just burst because their cell membrane is not designed to have the surface tension needed to contain tons of plasma. And so they'd probably just pop once you got them up to elephant size. On the other hand, if you shrunk an elephant down to the size of an amoeba, it's not going to function well at that size. It's not designed to swim around and function on that level. It's going to be very clumsy. It's going to be easy prey for things that are designed to function on that level, like amoebas. So I think that the most dangerous animals are going to be the ones that retain their natural size. If you make an animal bigger than its natural size, notably, or smaller than its natural size, you're going to be taking it out of its operational comfort zone. Whereas what animal, so if you have elephants shrunk down to the size of humans, well, okay, the human's going to have the advantage. If you have amoebas expanded up to the size of humans, well, humans are going to have the advantage. Whatever animal retains its natural size in this scheme is probably going to be the more dangerous animal, as opposed to animals that have been dramatically changed in size, either up or down, who are not designed to work at the target scale.
Timothy, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. This one comes from Robert. I once read a really cool writing prompt that involved rogue Swiss guards time traveling to rescue Jesus from Calvary. What would be the ramifications if such a mission were successful? Would humanity be doomed? Would Jesus find a way back to Jerusalem around AD 33 and resume his mission? Would the guards be culpable of sin? Or is it in fact a fixed point in time that no time traveler can reach?
Okay, well, we should mention a fixed point of time, is, as the term is commonly used, is not one that is unreachable, but one that is unalterable. And we don't know whether the crucifixion is a fixed point in time or not. We've never, God hasn't told us, and we haven't run any experiments to find out. So we don't know what would happen if such a mission occurred. It's possible that Jesus could have found a way back and restored the timeline, which is the first possibility that that Robert mentions. It's possible he could have died in another way and redeemed us in that way. It's possible that we could have been redeemed without Jesus dying. This is something like Aquinas, for example, points out is God's choice to use this method. He didn't have to use this method. He could have done anything or nothing to redeem us and still redeemed us. And of course, if you thwart the crucifixion, it's possible that we might not be redeemed. It's also possible you get to the crucifixion and your face melts like a bunch of Nazis for trying to interfere with God's plans. So you might not be able to succeed. But if you did, we don't really know what would happen. I would say that that I don't consider all changing the past to be immoral, but I would say that it should be regarded as sinful to undertake this mission because its goal is interfering with God's known will for our timeline.
I gotcha. Okay. Robert, that's a very good... Oh, no, excuse me. Yeah, Robert, that was a very good question. We're doing so well. I think we can get a third question in before the first break. I think that that's... I want to go for that record.
Well, we won't if you keep talking.
Well, I'll just keep talking to Reed. Bennett asked, in the films Fantastic Voyage and Inner Space, people are shrunk and placed in other people's bodies. If it was a Sunday and the host went to Mass, would that count also for the Sunday obligation of the miniaturized humans, presuming they had an obligation? Would it be any different if it was the Doctor Who episode, Let's Kill Hitler, where they are shrunk inside a shape-shifting android?
Okay, so in both of these scenarios, it would count to fulfill your Sunday obligation. The minimal conditions in canon law for fulfilling your Sunday obligation or holy day obligation are being present at Mass and being conscious. So you can't just go and sleep. You need to be awake. And those are the minimal conditions. So other conditions like being able to hear or understand or see what's happening are not required. Otherwise, you know, deaf and blind people would never be able to fulfill their Sunday obligation if you can't, if seeing hearing what's going on is required. Similarly, needing to know the language is not required. Lots of people for loads of time would go to, say, Latin Mass who didn't speak Latin. And they fulfilled their obligation. So you don't need these other things. Just being present and being conscious are what you need. And so such conditions would seem to be met if you're shrunk down to tiny size and injected into a normal person, like in Fantastic Voyage. And they would seem to be fulfilled if you're shrunk down and put in a shape-shifting robot, like in the Doctor Who episode, Let's Kill Hitler.
All right. And we did it. That's three questions before the first break. Let's take that break. Be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at magnificat.com.
This is Father Leo Paddlinghug, and why do we need Catholic radio? Well, the answer is simple. The devil, who is very real, uses all forms of communication. And so if we are to understand our purpose in life, it's to make sure that we are not only proclaiming the good news, we're also listening to the good news. And how do you do that? With Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, which is an awful good thing because today's topic is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. I am Cy Kellett, your host. I get to read the questions that have been sent in. And this one comes from Peggy. Peggy asks, we pray that people rest in peace in heaven. If heaven is a place of peace and happiness, why are we also taught that it makes Mary sad to see our disobedience? Is this premise wrong? There is no pain or suffering in heaven?
Well, okay, so Peggy says we are also taught that it makes Mary sad to see our disobedience. Taught by whom? This is not something you're going to find in church documents. You're not going to have an encyclical from the Pope saying it makes Mary sad in heaven to see this. This is something that you hear, like, maybe parents say or teachers say or, you know, people who do children's programs at church say, but it's not church teaching. What is church teaching is that that heaven is a place of peace and happiness. And the book of Revelation says there's not going to be any more crying or sadness or anything like that in heaven. So how I've always understood this is statements like, you know, you're going to make Mary sad by doing this, or baby Jesus cries when he sees people doing this. Those are meant to be catechetical aids. They are meant to help educate people in what they should not do by giving them an emotional hook to help them understand the negative nature of the action they're performing. It's such that it would make Mary sad or would make baby Jesus cry if they were not in the happiness of heaven. The same thing is also true in Scripture of statements about God's anger. You know, anger is a negative emotion, and God doesn't literally have that. God is in the infinite joy of heaven. He doesn't literally get angry, but Scripture sometimes uses the metaphor of God being angry to indicate that what people have done in this situation is wrong and it can have negative consequences for them. And it's like they've angered, quote unquote, angered God, like you could anger another person by disobeying him and violating his will. But these are catechetical aids. They're not meant to be statements of literal truth.
All right. I feel like the next question has some relation to that. This one comes from Mark. How do emotions function in the afterlife? Aren't emotions a product of the brain? In the afterlife, before the resurrection, you have no brain.
Well, we don't know for sure how emotions function in the afterlife. I mean, we covered what's revealed about it, but even given that it's supposed to be supremely joyful and so forth, we don't have firsthand experience of that at present. However, Revelation, like in the book of Revelation, and also near-death experiences suggest that people do have emotions in the afterlife. And if you want to check out some Mysterious World episodes on that, you might go back and listen to episode 27 on near-death experiences, and also episode 292 on distressing near-death experiences, where people report negative emotions during the context of a near-death experience. What near-death experiences do, as well as things that we are told about the afterlife in Scripture, like the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, or the vision of heaven that John gets in the book of Revelation, what all that suggests is consciousness is just not dependent on the brain. And emotions are just not dependent on the brain. So you can have emotions in the even when your body and your brain are offline, just like you can have intellectual experiences when your body and brain are offline.
Thank you very much for that question. That was Mark. And on we go to Anthony. Anthony wants to know this. Oh, I want to know this too, Anthony. What happened during the apparition of Our Lady of Zaytun, right?
Zaytun is the local pronunciation.
Okay. What happened during the apparition of Our Lady of Zaytun?
Okay, so Zaytun is like a suburb of Cairo, Egypt. And one night back in, I want to say 1968, there were some Muslim guys at a bus station, you know, where they
where the buses were housed when they weren't in service, and they do work on them and stuff. And this is right across the street from a Coptic church of St. Mary. And all of a sudden, they noticed that there's a light on top of the church. And when they look closer, it's like the illuminated figure of a woman. And at first, they thought that it was a young woman who was about to commit suicide, about to jump off the roof. And like one of the guys who had one of the workmen who had a gangrenous finger that was scheduled to be amputated like the next day or something, he pointed and said, "Don't jump." But then the woman didn't jump. And it turned out that other people identified her as the Virgin Mary because she seemed to be glowing up on top of the church. And this led to a series of apparitions that were witnessed by at least 250,000 people. So these were very well attended. The apparitions lasted for a period of like 3 years. In addition to seeing the lighted figure of the Virgin Mary, they also saw giant dove-like shapes made out of light that would glide around the Virgin Mary. At times she would bless people. People would ask for healings and get them. In fact, the guy with the gangrenous finger, his finger got ungangrened really fast. He didn't have to have it amputated. And to ensure that these were not just some form of trickery, they not only like shut off the electricity, they cut down the trees around the church so you could have an unobstructed view. They looked for alternative light sources. There were no alternative light sources. They turned off the power. They actually broke the street lights to keep the street lights, so the street lights couldn't be playing a role. They're doing it a little haphazardly, but basically they're doing a controlled scientific experiment here. They're introducing new controls and seeing, can we affect the outcome by introducing controls? Like, okay, let's break the street lights now and see if that affects it. And the controls didn't eliminate the apparitions. They went on for 3 years. If you'd like to learn more about that, you can check out episode 283 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. That's at mysterious.fm/283. And the miracle was approved officially by the Coptic Patriarch, the Coptic Pope. And it was unofficially endorsed as well by Catholic authorities who were tasked with investigating it. But since it was happening at a Coptic church rather than a Catholic church, the Catholic church didn't want to like intrude, you know, and say, well, and presumptively issue a ruling on it themselves. But they did unofficially look into it and said, yeah, this looks real.
Anthony, thank you very much for asking that question. Here's another question from Anthony. While we know that Anglican orders are null and void, according to Leo XIII, do Protestant sacraments outside of baptism and matrimony communicate any sort of grace? I mispronounced that. Sorry.
So some Protestant Eucharists will end up being valid because of special ordination situations. Like if you have a Catholic priest who's been validly ordained, or an Eastern Orthodox priest who's validly ordained, and then they become a Protestant, well, okay, then they're going to still have the power to consecrate the Eucharist, even though they're doing it in a Protestant context now. So there will be individual Protestant Eucharists that are going to be perfectly valid and communicate grace just like Catholic ones do. When it comes to other Protestant Eucharists and other sacraments, which generally Protestants are not going to call sacraments, most Protestants, there are some variations in like the Anglican and Lutheran circles, but most Protestants and even many Anglicans and Lutherans will acknowledge baptism and the Eucharist as sacraments, or at least ordinances, as they're called in some Protestant churches, but they're not going to consider other things to be sacraments. However, they frequently will have rites that are equivalent to them. And so even though they're not calling them sacraments, they do recognize them as religious rites where we're doing something sacred. We're trying to please God. you know, we're wanting a spiritual connection with him. And in that case, they're going to function effectively like sacramentals. So in the Catholic Church, we have a difference between sacraments and sacramentals. Sacraments were instituted by Christ, and they carry a divine promise that if you do the right, God will make his grace available through it. And as long as you don't put a barrier in the way, like mortal sin, you're going to get the grace. So you got this divine promise, and it was instituted by Christ. Sacramentals, on the other hand, are instituted by the church. So there is, it's a sacred rite, but it's instituted by the church, and it does not have a divine promise of communicating grace. So it's not automatic. But if you have a person use the sacramental in a pious way where they're reaching out to God spiritually and asking to be blessed by him, then he may well give them his blessing through the sacramental. And so basically, Protestant sacraments that are not valid are going to function like sacramentals because the people are still reaching out to God spiritually and hoping to be blessed by him. And God can still be pleased by their action and bless them through this effective sacramental.
Thank you very much for that question. Now we got a Star Trek question. I always like when we get one of these. Anthony asks, in Star Trek, how do some phrases in other languages not get automatically translated, like kapla? Would you need to mentally have the intention to speak Klingon in the one instance, or is there something else going on?
Okay, so Sykela, do you happen to know what kapla means?
It seems to me that it's something negative, but I it's a Klingon. But
it is a Klingon thing.
But maybe everything the Klingons say sounds negative to me. I don't know. I don't know what it means. No.
Actually, kapla means victory, and it's commonly used as a farewell salutation. So if you're sending your buddy away, you wish him victory. Kapla.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even though they translate most of what Klingons say, they don't translate things like kapla or select other phrases. And the same thing is true of Romulans and so forth. The truth is, this is an inconsistency in the show writing. The writers want two separate things. They want the exoticness of hearing words in an alien language, but they also want the vast bulk of what the aliens say to be perfectly intelligible to the English-speaking audience. And to explain the latter, they have come up with this concept known as a universal translator, which appears to be a device that is maybe stored in the ears of the people, although they're not real clear about this. It looks like Ferengi, at least, store the universal translator in their ears. And it mechanically translates the languages that you're interacting with. This is different than the TARDIS on Doctor Who or the Babel Fish in The Hitchhiker's Guide. Both of those operate telepathically. But the Star Trek's universal translator seems to be just an advanced version of Google Translate. It's purely mechanical. It's presumably run by artificial intelligence. And so they've explained why, at least kind of, explained why the aliens on Star Trek all seem to speak English. What they have not done is give us an explanation for individual words and phrases like kapla that are left untranslated. So they simply haven't tried to explain that on the show. But there are a number of possibilities, including momentarily shutting off the universal translator so that what you say doesn't get translated. That could be possibly done through a neural interface. Even if you've got the translator embedded in your ear, you may have a neural interface with the translator that will allow you to turn it on and off. And that could, you could, if you want to be extra Klingon-y for a moment, say kapla and tell your universal translator not to translate that. So that's a possibility, but it raises other problems that they just haven't addressed on the show. Like if I'm shutting off my translator, why does that affect your ability to hear me in English?
Yeah.
You know, if I'm speaking Klingon to you and I shut off my translator, I'm still speaking Klingon. Why are you not hearing me in English? How am I turning off your universal translator?
Yeah. And you wonder if someone could quote Hamlet in the original Klingon and turn
it
off.
It is the best in the original Klingon.
Yeah. Were you aware of that, Darren, that Hamlet was originally written in Klingon? Oh. Undiscovered country. All right. We got to take
the Gospels have also been translated into Klingon.
Oh, yeah, because Klingon's a real functioning language now.
Yeah.
All right. You know who needs the gospel is the Klingons.
Yeah, absolutely. They killed their own gods.
All right. We got to take a very quick break. Lots more weird questions for Jimmy Akin coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's a Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour, and last hour as well, if you want to go back and listen to that. These weird questions come from all over the place, but they find their way to Jimmy, and then we collect them up and do a show with them. And this one comes from Tamara. Would the church permit samples of DNA to be taken from the canonized saints so we can trace our saintly relatives?
Well, it's so normally decisions are made when you say, would the church permit this? The church doesn't have any law against it. So it would really be an administrative decision on the part of the individuals that are responsible for caring for the bodies or relics of a particular saint. For example, in, it's not Prague, it's Dubrovnik, the former Yugoslavia, they have a relic of Saint Blaise, you know, the throat guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you went to the bishop of Dubrovnik and said, could we take a DNA sample of St. Blaise, you know, he'd have some questions like, how much are you going to take? Because they're not going to want to damage the integrity of the relic they have. But it's like, oh, no, we just need a little, you know, a little moist swab, you know, and that'll give us all we need. Well, he might say yes to that. But this is going to be a series of decisions made by different individuals, unless the Pope chooses to intervene and issue a church-wide law on this subject. But at present, the church doesn't have any church-wide law on this subject, so the decision would be made by the individual custodians of the relics of the canonized saints. Now, in order to get the data for a saintly DNA database, you need to convince the custodians that you have a legitimate reason for wanting the DNA samples. And not just a reason, but a good reason. And my thought at present is not many of the custodians would think letting people trace their connection to saintly ancestors they don't presently know about or saintly relatives they don't presently know about, that's not going to be a sufficient reason in the mind of most of them for allowing the disturbance of saintly relics. Having said that, though, as DNA tests have already begun to be less intrusive than they used to be. You need much less material to sequence someone's DNA than you used to. And as they become more familiar and more regular for people to have them, you could have a change of attitude on the part of the custodians of saintly relics. And at some point, you know, maybe someday you might have such a saintly DNA database. But at present, I don't think it's very likely.
Thanks for the question, Tamara. I appreciate that. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and this one comes from Matt. I just had the chance to see Sister Wilhelmina in Missouri. I would love to know your opinion on incorrupt saints. I'm not sure what to think. Pretty close to Fayetteville, too, so you could make it a day trip if you haven't already.
Yeah, in fact, they've had at least one one-day pilgrimage up to Missouri to view the remains of Sister Wilhelmina. For people who may not be familiar, she was a nun, and I forget if she was a foundress of her house, but she lived up in western Missouri and just north of where I am in northwest Arkansas, and her remains were discovered to be remarkably free from corruption, even though they'd been exposed to dirt and water and things like that in the intervening time. And today they have them, under glass to preserve them and so forth. And I do plan to go up and visit and even do an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World about Sister Wilhelmina and other saints with incorrupt bodies. I don't at present have any kind of generalized opinion about incorrupt saints because I haven't done a ton of research on them at this point. There are cases of reported incorruption that are not as dramatic as often thought. You know, when you hear someone's remains are incorrupt, you think, oh, they're just like they were when they were alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not always. They may not have rotted in a visible way, but they don't necessarily look exactly like when the person was alive. And there are cases, there are natural phenomena that can result in incorrupt-like results. For example, one of the classics that's been around for thousands of years and has been known about for thousands of years is dehydration. If the remains are in a place where they are effectively dehydrated, they will mummify. That's how the Egyptians got the practice of mummification. They would bury people in the desert, and because that's what they got in Egypt, and they would dry out, and that would preserve their remains. And eventually they said, hey, we could do this a little bit better than nature. And they developed a mummification process. But the key to mummification is dehydration, so that the microbes that would otherwise go to work on decomposing flesh and cause the decomposition, the microbes don't have any moisture. And that stops the decomposition process and results in a body that looks fairly incorrupt, like a lot of the pharaohs. You can look at Ramesses the Great. He's the probable pharaoh of the Exodus. You can see his face today because of how his body has been preserved for the last 3,000 years. Another process that has been, I don't know if it's been known for as long, but it's certainly been around for a very, very long time, is bogification. There, periodically in Western Europe, people will find, individuals will find what are known as bog people. Bog people are human corpses that are found at the bottom of bogs. And it, in many cases, it looks like they were human sacrifices, like they were deliberately killed and ceremonially and then put in the bog, presumably to appease spirits of some kind. Well, okay, so at the bottom of bogs, you do have water, so they're not dehydrated, but you're missing something else that microbes need: air. And so there's no oxygen in the deep down in these bogs. There's not enough oxygen for the microbes to go to work on a person's remains. And so the remains look remarkably well preserved. Then there's a process known as saponification. Saponification is a chemical reaction that occurs in the fat that humans have. Now, Cykelet, have you ever had a bar of lye soap?
Lye soap?
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And does lye soap float or sink in the bathtub?
I believe it's, I don't know. I can't remember. I don't remember having the bathtub.
It floats. Okay. It floats. And lye soap, like other forms of soap, is essentially made out of a couple of elements, one of which is fat. So fat is one of the principal components of soap. And because of various properties relating to water and fat and electrical charges, which I won't go into, we can use soap to clean ourselves. Well, since one of the principal components of soap is fat, and people have fat, there are chemical reactions that can occur in a deceased human body that will effectively convert their body fat into something that's basically soap. And this is known as saponification. Oh. Well, soap has a long shelf life.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't just rot. And so if saponification occurs in a human body, then that body will tend to be well preserved over time. So whenever I hear about someone like Sister Wilhelmina or other reported incorruptibles, I want to know, okay, so what are the factors that apply in this case? Could dehydration be a factor? Could oxygen deprivation be a factor? And could saponification be a factor? If none of those factors apply, though, then that gives you good reason to propose a supernatural cause has been involved, mm-hmm. in addition to any natural processes that may play a role.
To your knowledge, have they done any of that on those kind of studies on Sister Wilhelmina, or... We don't know.
I have not heard results of any such studies.
Okay. Matt, thank you very much for the question. We're going to take a quick break. Be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Our topic, weirdness. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin. This one comes from Dan. Jimmy, can guardian angels be assigned to more than one person?
Well, we don't know. I wouldn't exclude the possibility because, you know, I don't know what the limits of angels are. It could well be that angels are capable of effectively guarding multiple people at once. And so if that's the case, then you could have one guardian angel guarding a bunch of different people totally effectively, you know, without a problem. Also, people don't always need guarding. Once you're in heaven, you're safe. And so you don't need guarding in heaven. And your former guardian angel might not have a lot to do and might get reassigned to another person. So either synchronically, meaning at one time, or diachronically, meaning across multiple times, I can imagine a guardian angel guarding multiple people. What I'm confident of is that God will make sure everybody receives a good degree of guarding, regardless of whether it's with one angel or guarding multiple people or just you, or he might even swap them out. They might go on leave and they, you know, they might have a rotation of assignments. You might not have the same exact guardian your entire life, but God will make sure you get the guardian you need.
Dan, thank you very much. I wonder where angels go on leave. Florida.
In heaven.
Probably. Oh, heaven. Oh, okay. Almost the same thing. Terry asks this. Neanderthals and Denisovans were sufficiently like us that our ancestors interbred with them.
Yep.
In spiritual terms, do we consider them to be as human as we are because they were so close to us physically and in some aspects culturally? Did they suffer from original sin?
Okay, so the church has no teaching on this. So all of this is, everything I'm about to say is just informed speculation. Neanderthals and Denisovans were not on the mental map of the author of Genesis. And so divine revelation in the Bible is silent about Neanderthals and Denisovans and what their relationship to us is. The Bible does present us with a with an account of the origin of mankind that indicates that human beings are created by God. We're willed by him, we're endowed with, by him with certain attributes and so forth. And we turned away from him as a species very early in our history, which explains human sin down through history. If you go by the biblical vision of man, you could refer to this as biblical man. Man in the sense that the authors of the Bible understood man. But that doesn't tell us about these different human subspecies. Now, we have some human sort of subspecies today. We call them races. So you've got different variations on humanity among the different races, you know, Caucasians, Africans, Asians, and so forth. Kind of like you've got different breeds among dogs. You know, you have in a given family, you know, family characteristics are passed down, and races are basically like big families. And of course, we can interbreed because we're all the same species. Well, what about these other humans that were slightly different than us, a little more different, like Neanderthals and Denisovans? Well, because they're not the races are on the mind map of the author of Genesis. He knows about different races, and he considers them all human. And so, you know, Adam and Eve are the parents of all humans. There's nobody that's part of the human family that is excluded from that common lineage in the biblical author's mind. So we're all humans. We're all children of our first parents. But he didn't know, the author of Genesis didn't know about Neanderthals and Denisovans. So he doesn't give us any information about, are they part of the human family or are they a separate creation or what are they? My suspicion is that if you got a time machine and you got a Neanderthal and you got a Denisovan and you took them to the author of Genesis and let him interact with them. You know, my guess is he might well conclude, yeah, there are other people. They're different, you know, than us and than me, the author of Genesis, but there are other people. And if there are other people, then I would say they fit within in the author of the in the mind of the biblical authors. If they met them, then I would say we have a presumptive case that they are part of biblical man, and thus there would be a case that they have original sin, just like we do, which I think also we have evidence for anyway, since they seem to live lives based on the archaeological evidence that were nasty, brutish, and short and involved a lot of violence. So I think that we have good evidence independently that they had the same kind of violent, sinful tendencies that we do. But I also suspect they would fit within the biblical conception of man if you were able to introduce the biblical authors to Neanderthals and Denisovans. I suspect they would conclude, yeah, they're fundamentally us, even though they're different than most of us.
Yeah. Do we know, do they have linguistic ability? They could talk like we can.
This is debated.
Oh, okay.
We don't have, especially with the Denisovans, we don't have enough of their remains to mm-hmm. know. With Neanderthals, they may have had linguistic abilities. Those abilities, though, may not have been verbal. They may have been gestural. There is some indication that the origins of human language may have been tilted to a significant degree towards sign languages, because even if you can't articulate precisely to generate a large number of different words, you could point mm-hmm. and you can use gestures to communicate. And so there is just like you can have chimpanzees that can have some facility with sign language, even if they are physically incapable of producing the sounds of human speech with their mouths. In the case of Neanderthals, I think they probably had the ability to produce the sounds, at least most of them. But I don't know if they had the cognitive architecture needed to do full human language.
All right. Again, thank you for the question, Terry. This one comes from Amanda. Some parts of the brain can still be functioning in a person considered brain dead. Does that mean the person's soul is still in the body, and so they aren't actually dead? And do you think the Lazarus sign or Lazarus reflex is just that, a reflex, and not an indication of a person isn't really dead?
Okay, so personally, I am concerned that brain death is not an adequate criterion for physical death. It is commonly treated as one, but I just have a lot of suspicions in this area. And I'm not convinced that brain death is an adequate criterion for determining physical death. The soul, or some kind of soul, may still be present in the body. Now, here we get into an interesting discussion from the Middle Ages about philosophy. As you may well know, Psychelet, Aristotle distinguished between different kinds of souls: animal souls, vegetative souls, and sensitive souls, and rationals. So let me back up. Vegetative souls, like plants have, which convey the ability to consume matter and reproduce and live and things like that. Sensitive souls, which animals have, that allow them to sense and engage in a primitive form of reasoning. And then rational souls, which humans have, which in addition to allowing us to sense and grow and reproduce and things like that, we also can think in a rational way. Now, there's a question about, so, okay, how many souls do we got?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I can think rationally, so I've got a rational soul, but I can also sense things. Does that mean I have a sensitive soul too? And I can grow and reproduce. Does that mean I have a vegetative soul? Well, Aquinas' answer to that was no. Aquinas' view was that the abilities of each soul type are included in the highest form of soul you have. So if you've got a rational soul, it entails the ability of lesser souls. And according to Aquinas, you only have one soul, which is the substantial form of your body. Not everybody agreed with that. And Aquinas's view is not actually church teaching. So there is room for differences of opinion here. Another, about a century after Aquinas, there was another extraordinarily famous and sharp philosopher and theologian named John Duns Scotus. And according to Scotus, our bodies have multiple different forms, which is what gives them gives individual parts of the body their identity, for example. So your heart has the form of a heart. Your liver has the form of a liver. That's what makes them hearts and livers and distinct from each other. And if you want to call them souls, you can call them souls. But at a certain point, you had the Council of Vienna meet in the 1300s. And what they did was they issued a dogmatic definition that said the intellectual soul is the form of the human body. So that's church teaching. The intellectual soul is the form of the human body. It's the thing that integrates the human body and allows it to live and so forth. But it didn't comment on these other souls or other forms. So it didn't teach Aquinas's view that we only have one soul or only have one form to our bodies. It left room for the Scotists and their views. But to keep from getting into trouble and causing confusion, thereafter the Scotists didn't really refer to like the form of your heart as the soul of your heart. They called it a form but it's the same thing. Okay. Basically, it's a soul or a form. You can call it either one. So it's possible that the body has multiple forms or multiple souls, even if they're not called that. The intellectual soul is the one that is the one to rule them all. It's the one that governs the entire body. But you could have other ones. And that leads to what happens in out-of-body experiences. In out-of-body experiences, people have a shift of perspective where they aren't viewing things from the ordinary perspective inside their bodies. They may, for example, be up at the ceiling looking down on their bodies, or they may go to some distant location out-of-body. And there's a debate in parapsychology about, does anything actually leave your body when you're having an out-of-body experience? Some out-of-body experiencers said yes. There's a famous one in the 1980s named Alex Tanis, and he referred to his mental self that could leave his body as Alex 2. So he would send Alex 2 to go view some remote location. But he was very convinced, my soul is still in my body, because if it wasn't, I would die. But he viewed Alex 2 as a little part of him he could split off. Other out-of-body experiencers, like Graham Nichols, who's still alive, still with us today, is of the opposite view, says nothing leaves the body. You're just remotely viewing other locations. So if someone is brain dead, there might or might not be other things besides the soul that could be keeping the body running. Near-death experiences similar, something seems to be leaving the body. So it's ambiguous exactly what's running the body and does stuff leave it or not. But to deal with Amanda's question, I'm not at all convinced brain death is an adequate criterion. When it comes to the Lazarus sign, that's a reflex. If you manipulate brain dead person's head, their arms may come up and cross their chest, kind of like a pharaoh. And despite my skepticism on is brain death an adequate criterion, the Lazarus sign could just be a reflex. It may not indicate that the person's soul is still there. I need to study that more.
Amanda, thank you for that question. That brings an end to the Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, thank you for two really enjoyable hours.
My pleasure.
And I hope you have a blessed Lent.
Likewise.
And that does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.